Hello, everyone. Thank you all for being here. My name is Kim Roeder, and I work in the alumni office, and I'm so excited to see so many of you here for our presentation. I have the pleasure of introducing Professor Julia McQuaid. She has dedicated her career to expanding the frontiers of knowledge and nurturing the intellectual growth of her students. Her educational journey in academia began with a Bachelor of Arts from Bates College, we won't hold that against her, and a doctorate in clinical psychology from the University of Vermont. She joined the faculty at Amherst College in 2019 and is currently an associate professor of psychology and the chair of the department. Wow.
Outgoing,
okay. Her courses cover topics of psychopathology and psychological research. She also teaches an in-depth seminar on child and adolescent clinical psychology. I could certainly have used that about 10 years ago. And environmental processes that influence the social emotional functioning of children and adolescents. Much of her work has focused on aspects of child self-regulation, including a diagnosis of ADHD and the cognitive impairments related to executive functioning. Professor McQuaid's commitment to academic excellence, her passion for teaching, and her desire to continue to learn in her field makes her such a valuable asset to our community. So please welcome Professor McQuaid.
Thank you so much. It's nice to see you all, and nice to get an opportunity to talk a little bit about my research. So I'm going to be talking about research that's come out of my lab at Amherst College. So I got here in 2012, so this is the work that's happened in the past decade. And I'm going to focus on some of the work I've done trying to understand how we teach children about emotions. So as Kim said, I am a clinical psychologist, which means that I study psychological disorders in children. And so in order for me to talk about how I got to this subject of how we teach children, especially how parents teach children, I'll give you a little bit of background. So when I came to the college in 2012, I was really focused on the social and emotional challenges that children with ADHD have. Most of us have heard about ADHD. These are kids who have really pervasive challenges with attention, hyperactivity, impulsivity, and those play out in impairments in a variety of areas of their life. One thing we often see for children with ADHD is that they struggle to regulate their emotions. So they become really big in their emotions, and when they're emotional, they have a lot of trouble figuring out, how am I going to modulate this so that I can keep my behavior in line? Kids with ADHD also often struggle socially. So other children in their class don't like them. They don't want to be their friend. They're less likely to have mutual friends. When they are interacting socially, they tend to be more intrusive and annoying, and they engage in behaviors that really turn peers off. And so when I got to Amherst, I was really focused on trying to understand why children with ADHD were struggling socially, emotionally, if there were any things within the child that could help us identify which kids would struggle the most. And then what happened is 3 years into my position here, I had my first baby. and that baby is now an 8-year-old baby. That's Adina, okay? 3 years after that, I had my second baby. That's my 5-year-old baby, Vincent, okay? And I think for all of us, how many are parents in the room? Raise your hand. Okay. Yeah. So being a parent is a humbling experience. It is particularly humbling when you are supposed to be an expert in the social and emotional adjustment of children. And so for me, having kids made me really start to think about parents. And so I started to think about this question in my research of like, well, what about parents? And what about parents for children with ADHD who are struggling socially and emotionally often? Can parents do anything about this? And so what I did is in my research, it started here, is that I started to think about parenting. And I focused on this specific aspect of parenting that the field calls parent emotion socialization, as in the ways that we socialize or teach children about emotions, okay? And parents do this in a lot of ways. And you can think about your own family growing up. What did they do when you were upset? What did your parents do when they were upset? So we teach parents in many ways, we teach children in many ways about emotions. So part of this is in the ways that, what do we do when we're emotional ourselves? Some parents are very explicitly talking about emotions, labeling emotions with children, coaching children on emotions. Parents also react in different ways when kids get emotional. So my work on parent emotion socialization has focused on a specific aspect, which is really what are parents doing when their child experiences negative emotions, okay? So how do they respond in those moments? And in, this is a subject matter that developmental psychologists have been studying for a long time, that we actually have a lot of information about. And in the field, they've often thought about parent reactions to children's negative emotions in these two broad categories. One of them are these supportive reactions. And what are generally considered supportive reactions when your child is sad or scared or frustrated would be things like validating that emotion, encouraging kids to express it, like it's okay to cry, problem solving with your child. Let's figure out what we could do to maybe fix this situation that caused the problem, or coaching kids on how they might feel better, how they might cope with that emotion. And so those are generally considered supportive reactions for children. And what the research suggests more broadly is that when parents more frequently respond to kids' negative emotions with these supportive reactions, children tend to have better emotional awareness. They tend to be able to tolerate emotions better. They tend to be able to independently learn to regulate their emotions more. So kids learn from their parents. The other side are what are sometimes called non-supportive reactions that parents may do. What are considered generally non-supportive reactions to children's negative emotions would be things like getting really distressed yourself when your child is upset, minimizing it. It's not a big deal. Like, don't worry about it. Or sometimes maybe things that are a little more punitive. Like, if you can't pull it together, we're going to have to leave. You can't be here. Okay? And what I will say as a parent is that I certainly am not always supportive and never non-supportive. So as I'm saying this, if you ever are imagining that with your kids you did some of those less ideal things, don't worry. What we're thinking about here is generally what parents are doing, and we're also thinking about what are they doing in the situations when the emotions are pretty well-founded, where it's reasonable for a child to feel upset or scared or sad. And so what research suggests, though, is that if parents are frequently being non-supportive, children tend to have difficulty regulating their emotions, they stay aroused longer, and they don't really develop those skills around emotions, and they're often taught that emotions are not okay. So there's a lot of literature on parent emotion socialization in children more generally. I was interested in figuring out, well, how does this work for children with ADHD? And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk to you a little bit about a couple published studies I've done in this field from research that was collected right here at Amherst College with undergraduate students to help me, just so that you can see a little bit about what I've learned about this subject. So as I said, I'm going to start by talking about one study we did a couple years ago. I featured over here some of my wonderful undergrads who are now alums who helped me with this data. So Becky Zakarian's the first one right there, and this was actually part of her honors thesis, so she's a co-author on this study. But Angelina Gomez, Christy Larson, Taylor Penzel, and Destiny Casillas also helped with this data collection. So in the first study I did on parent emotion socialization in children with ADHD, we did what was somewhat of a simple study. We recruited families from the community around here, invited them to my research lab space, which was at rundown old Merrill back then. And we tried to recruit in a sample that was about half kids with ADHD and half kids without. And we assessed them and diagnosed them, so we had that established. And one of the things we measured is we measured parent emotion socialization, specifically how are parents tending to react when their children experience negative emotions. And so we did this with a rating scale that's often used. Parents read some hypothetical situations, and they really rated how often do they react in different ways, so that we had a sense of like that parent's typical responses. 1 year later, all those kids came back into our research lab so we could follow up with them. And at that second time point, we measured children's emotion dysregulation. It's just sort of the flip side of emotion regulation. Really, this was about how emotionally reactive was the child, how much did they struggle, or did they lack emotion regulation skills? And we used a teacher and parent report to try to get at that. And so in this study, what I was really interested in, though, was like the role that ADHD symptoms would play. So we already knew there was a lot of research to suggest good emotion socialization, less emotion dysregulation in general. But I wanted to figure out, like, how does this work for children with ADHD? And there was almost really two ways of thinking about it. So on the one hand, we already know that children with ADHD tend to struggle with emotion regulation, so it's really hard for them. And part of that may be about biological challenges that they have that make it hard to modulate emotions. And from that perspective, it might be that because of those internal challenges, it doesn't really matter what parents do. It wouldn't really matter if they're sort of supportive or they're never non-supportive. For children with ADHD, they may struggle no matter what. The flip side, though, is that there was some other research more broadly suggesting that children with ADHD seem to be very sensitive to their environment. And for other kinds of parenting factors, when we modify parenting, it can really shape children with ADHD and their behavior and help to mitigate some of their impairments. So from that angle, it might actually be that children with ADHD are even more sensitive and might benefit even more from parent emotion socialization, these like healthy, healthy and good kinds of responses. So we wanted to try to see if that would be the case, all right? So that's the basic gist of the study. At the end, there's time for questions. If you're wondering about the details, you can always ask me, okay? So here's what we found. So one of the things we looked at was supportive responses from parents. So again, we were really asking parents, how often do you validate your child? Do you help your child problem solve? Or do you coach your child in coping with emotions when they're feeling upset? Okay, that was the gist of what supportive reactions are. And what we found is that in the whole sample, regardless of whether the child had ADHD or not, the more supportive responses parents said they were using, so the more frequently they engaged in that behavior, the better children's emotion regulation skills were 1 year later. And this was true even when we accounted for the fact that some of these kids had ADHD, so it didn't matter. This supportive responses were useful. Okay? When we looked at non-supportive responses, so that's like, are they minimizing their child's negative emotions? Are they punishing children when they're experiencing negative emotions? It was a little more complicated. What we found is that for children without ADHD, so for the kids in our sample who did not have a diagnosis of ADHD, it actually didn't matter whether or not parents frequently were non-supportive. So it didn't matter if they minimized or they punished their kids. It was not connected at all to the child's emotional reactivity. No relationship. So for these kids, it didn't really matter. But for the children who had ADHD, what we found is that the more non-supportive parents tended to be, the more they minimized, the more they punished their child's negative emotions, the more emotional reactivity the child tended to have. So this actually suggests that for children with ADHD, these non-supportive responses can be particularly damaging. And that for those kids in particular, those kind of reactions may not be very helpful, okay? So great, so this was really the first study that was ever done looking at this question of whether parent emotion socialization matters specifically for children with ADHD. So we established that yes, it does, and maybe it even matters more, okay? So we've established this, emotion socialization connected to emotion dysregulation, even for kids with ADHD. What we did with this sample that I just talked about, so I was talking about like a pretty short follow-up just 1 year later, we actually held on to these kids and we reassessed them 5 to 6 years later when they were all adolescents, once they were all 13 to 18 years old, so that we could look at the long-term effects of what parents were doing during childhood. So I'm gonna talk about another published study that we did. This is Daria Taubin, this is Ariana Morty. Both of them are currently in programs to get their degree, PhDs in clinical psychology. So they were integral in helping me collect the follow-up data for this study. They're both co-authors on this paper. This was part of their honors thesis work. So in this study, we actually wanted to see the downstream effects in adolescents. And one of the things that's also talked about with parent emotion socialization and these reactions, what parents are doing when kids are upset, is that they also may have implications for children's social development. And part of that might be that if you're very sensitive to your child when they're emotional, you're modeling good social skills, and kids may carry that with them into their peer relationships. But it's also possible that what's going on is that this kind of parenting might reduce the likelihood of emotion dysregulation. And we know a lot that when kids are emotionally dysregulated, they struggle with their peer relationships. So it may actually be this indirect effect that happens through an effect on emotion dysregulation. You with me? Okay, so we followed these kids up, and what happened is that we had that same measure in childhood of parents' supportive and non-supportive reactions. When they hit adolescence and we reassessed them, we re-measured adolescent emotion dysregulation. We had parent and adolescent reports of this on a rating scale.
And we had the adolescents report on their peer relationships and how those were going across a variety of domains, okay? So I'm gonna show you a couple of the results we found for this study, what was sort of most interesting to me. So the kind of parent reaction that seemed most important in these models was supportive reactions in childhood. So again, when kids are upset, is the parent validating? Are they problem solving? Are they coaching kids on how to cope, okay? And what we found is that parent supportive reactions, the more that parents were doing that in childhood, the less kids showed emotion dysregulation in adolescence. And so this is 5 to 6 years later. So that's a pretty downstream association that we're finding, okay? We also, though, wanted to understand, does this have then further effects or relationships to peer variables? And so we had a bunch of peer variables. One of the things we asked adolescents about was, like, how much support is there in your best friend relationship? So is this a healthy relationship? Do you go to them for comfort? Can you lean on them? And what we found is that these supportive reactions in childhood were actually indirectly associated with more best friend support through this mechanism of emotion dysregulation, okay? So it's called an indirect effect, statistically. We also found a similar indirect effect when we looked at befriending antisocial peers. So these are other kids who might be using drugs or stealing or engaging in the things you just maybe don't want your kid to do so much, okay? And we also found that the more supportive reactions parents were showing in childhood, that was also indirectly associated with less befriending of antisocial peers, and it was really through this mechanism of that these kids had less emotion dysregulation challenges. Finally, same kind of effect we also found when we looked at peer aggression, both like physical aggression, like are you pushing other kids, are you bullying, and also the manipulating relationships, excluding other kids, that sort of a thing. And what I'll say is that in these analyses we were doing, we were also accounting for the effect of ADHD symptoms in childhood, and it was the case that kids with ADHD, higher ADHD symptoms, they were more emotionally dysregulated, and they did show these social impairments. But independent of that, supportive reactions mattered. So it seems that what parents are doing, the extent to which they are validating, problem solving, coaching kids when they're upset, that seems to be useful and potentially protective against some of these downstream challenges with peers, okay? All right, so these are two studies in an ADHD sample suggesting that yes, these parent reactions in general matter, okay? As a psychologist, one of the things I teach my kids, or my kids, my students, one of the things I teach my students in class, though, is to speculate, to be critical of these kinds of general trends and to often ask the question of, like, maybe it's not that simple. Okay? And so what I would say is that it really probably can't be that simple, that always these parenting behaviors are helpful and good and useful. And so this was a question I've grappled with a lot in my research, and it's a question that researchers who study parenting have grappled with more broadly for a really long time. And one of the things we know from the parenting field more broadly is that children react differently to parenting behaviors. Not all children are the same. And so if you have more, how many people have more than one child in this room? Okay, if you have more than one child, you know this implicitly. Your children are different, and it may not really feel like it has anything to do with you. They enter into these relationships and into these worlds with unique personalities and challenges and vulnerabilities, and that also matters. And so researchers have been talking about this and investigating this for a long time. There's a lot of different models. One of the ones I really like is this model that's called the Differential Susceptibility Model by Boyce and Ellis, which is what it sounds like. It's proposing that children are differentially susceptible to their environment, okay? And that we have some kids who may be very sensitive to their environment and others that are less sensitive. And so that environment would also include what are parents doing? And I like this differential susceptibility model because they use this metaphor that maybe there are two kinds of children. There are orchids and there are dandelions. And I'm sure there's more flowers out there, but I like it in terms of its simplicity. So a dandelion kid, they can grow in a lot of contexts. Sure, they do need some things, but they can grow in a wide range of locations. Anyone in here ever had an orchid plant? Any orchid plants? How many people have killed an orchid plant? Yes? Okay. All right. I got gifted my first orchid plant
right after I had my son. He was weeks old, my second, so I had a three-year-old and an infant, and my friend said, here's an orchid plant. They're really easy to care for. And that thing was dead in 2 weeks, okay? Has anyone, though, like successfully nurtured an orchid plant? Yes, it can be done. Yes, it can be done. It just turns out orchids need a very specific nurturing environment in order to thrive. And so the idea here is that for children, there may be some children who need a very specific kind of environment, which may also include a specific kind of parenting. With that, they can flourish, but in other contexts, it's going to be harder for them in a way that it wouldn't be if you're a dandelion child. So I was really interested in this idea and how it would play out in terms of parent emotion socialization. So one of the ways that researchers are studying this differential susceptibility or different sensitivity is that researchers have been looking at differences in biological stress reactivity. So I have to get a little bio on you. I'm going to mostly gloss it. You can ask me more specific questions at the end. I'm just going to give you what you need to know, okay? So one of the things that happens when we encounter stress is that there are a lot of physical changes that occur that are really meant to help us cope with challenge. And part of those physical changes happen automatically and are a result to changes in the arousal level of our parasympathetic nervous system and our sympathetic nervous system. So when we have greater arousal of our parasympathetic nervous system, this is typically what happens when things are safe in our environment, sort of all systems go, and our heart rate can slow down, our breathing can slow, our blood pressure goes down, okay? When, though, the environment is sort of threatening or stressful in some way, most typically, we should see greater arousal of our sympathetic nervous system. So that greater arousal, we'll see an increase in our heart rate, increase in blood pressure, increase in breathing. And those are really designed to help us biologically cope with that challenge. So researchers have been measuring stress reactivity in terms of parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system reactivity in kids as an indicator of sensitivity. And oftentimes, researchers have conceptualized this parasympathetic reaction as a biological indicator of a child's emotion regulation capacity. So that's often a way it's conceptualized, okay? And they've conceptualized this sympathetic nervous system arousal as a biological indicator of emotional reactivity, okay? So I started to get interested in this, and I started to study and measure stress reactivity in my studies. So I'm going to tell you about one of the first studies we did looking at this, okay? So in this study, this is the same sample, okay? Half of the kids have ADHD, half of them do not. I had some great undergrads who helped me collect this data. Rose Miller, Lainey Mathias, Taylor Penzel, Christy Larson. Rose and Christy are both getting their PhD in clinical psychology. Taylor is in medical school right now, so these are wonderful people. And so what we were interested in this study is that we wanted to look at the connection between parent emotion socialization, same measure, so how often are parents engaging in supportive reactions and non-supportive reactions? Was that linked to children's social-emotional adjustment? So we measured sort of social-emotional adjustment based on teacher and parent reports, things like, are they liked by their peers? Are they pro-social? Do they share? Are they dysregulated? So we looked at a bunch of different indicators. And what we were really interested in, though, was this connection between these two things? Did it depend on the child's own stress reactivity? Okay. So here's how we measured stress reactivity in this study. So these participants came into my research lab. And you can actually measure parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system reactivity by attaching some electrodes in some specific parts of the body and monitoring some different things, okay? So we attached electrodes to our participants. We sat them in front of a computer. And these electrodes were getting indicators of parasympathetic and sympathetic arousal. We had them first do this baseline where they just sat there quietly, and they watched a video of fish swimming in a fish tank for about 3 minutes so that we could understand, well, what is their arousal like just at baseline? What is it when nothing has really happened that's sort of anomalous, okay? Then all of our participants engaged in this very short social stress task, okay? So in this task, what happened is that we told our participants that they were going to do a chat room task on a computer with other kids who were participating in the study at other research locations. That was a lie. In reality, there were no other kids. It was completely pre-programmed and fictitious.
But our children, our participants, thought they were going to interact with other kids. And we told them that in order to do this, we're going to have you make a short profile and answer some questions about yourself. We're going to take your picture. We're going to give that information to the other children so they know something about you. And then in the specific part in which we evoked some stress, we told our participants that right now the other kids are going to decide whether or not they want to chat with you about different topics. And in that, it was standardized and rigged so that our participant didn't get chosen very often. So they almost never got chosen. And this is a task that's been used in other research, and it is meant to evoke a very short experience of peer rejection or exclusion or social stress. It was 3.5 minutes. Okay, it was very short. We were able to grab a snippet of what their parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system did in terms of arousal, and then it ended. And then we did a lot of things to try to make everyone feel better. So we said, oh my gosh, we made a huge mistake. We didn't upload your profile right. The kids didn't know anything about you. That's why you didn't get chosen. It was all our fault. So we tried to do that to make kids feel better. At the end of the study, we debriefed them with their parents present. We told them, it's not really real. It was all fake. Almost all kids were okay. There were a couple that were upset. But that was how we sort of got this reaction of like, how does your stress reactivity change? Okay, all right, I'm not a monster, I promise. Okay, so what did we find? So this meant that what we had is that for all of our children, we had a sense of how does your parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system change? And what we ended up finding is that this relationship between supportive and non-supportive reactions and children's social emotional adjustment, it differed depending on what their physiology did when they experienced that social stress, okay? So one of the ways we measured this was that parasympathetic, which researchers have conceptualized as a biological indicator of emotion regulation, there is a sort of profile that seems typical. It was typical in our study. It has been argued to be the more adaptive profile of parasympathetic change during stress. What we found is that when kids showed that profile, the arguably adaptive profile, there was no relationship between how supportive parents were and our measures of social emotional adjustment. So for these kids who maybe physiologically have more capacity to regulate emotions, it really doesn't matter if parents were validating, if they were problem solving, if they were coaching kids on how to feel better. It really made no difference. Didn't predict how they were doing socially, emotionally, okay? For the kids, though, that didn't show that arguably adaptive pattern, what we found is that for those children specifically, the more supportive parents were, more they validated, more they problem solved, more they coached their kids when they were emotional, the better those kids' emotion regulation skills were, the more pro-social they were, that means they shared, they helped other kids, and the less peer rejected they were. So the less other kids didn't like them. And that also means the flip is true. So parents who weren't being supportive, their kids were struggling in these areas. So what this really means is that for this child who maybe physiologically has more vulnerability, more challenges with emotion regulation, supportive responses really matter, okay? So the other indicator we had, we also measured changes in sympathetic nervous system. This is really like fight or flight response kind of things, and is often sort of conceptualized as a way of understanding level of emotional reactivity. So the children who showed, again, arguably the profile that's more adaptive, that we would maybe expect to show in terms of this, for them, no relationship between non-supportive responses and our social emotional adjustment. So again, in terms of sympathetic nervous system, for these kids, it doesn't matter, did you minimize, did you say, oh, just get over it? Did you punish the kid and say, we're going home unless you suck it up and feel better? It doesn't matter. It had nothing to do with their social emotional adjustment. But again, for the kids who didn't show that adaptive pattern of sympathetic arousal to that social stress, for those children, the more non-supportive parents were, the more dysregulated those kids were with their peers, the more aggressive they were, and the more rejected they were by their peers. So what this is it is kind of that idea that there could be these dandelions and orchids, that like for some kids, if you have a child with certain internal physiological capabilities, it maybe doesn't matter so much what you are doing in terms of emotion socialization. They're relatively hardy. But potentially for these children who are more vulnerable, who are lacking some of these internal capacities, this kind of reaction really could matter. It might compensate or help teach children skills that they really need, or in the case of non-supportive, really undermine the development in certain ways. Okay? All right, good. So I want to spend a little time talking about what's next. So I've just talked about three published studies that were really focused on how children are regulating negative emotions. So that's things like being sad and angry and scared, and what are parents doing for those things. And the truth of the matter is that if you want to study negative emotions in kids, you do end up doing some of these tasks, like stressing them out a little bit, making them feel bad for a moment so that we can see what happens. And so our lab has actually decided to move in a slightly different direction going forward. And we've started to think about positive emotions. Things like joy, happiness, excitement, amusement. And this is a sort of newer field. So we have been studying negative emotion regulation for a long time as a field. More recently, I'd say in the past 10 years, clinical psychologists are really starting to pay attention to how do we regulate positive emotions. It turns out we do that. It also turns out that parents are reacting to children's positive emotions and are teaching children also about their positive emotions. Most of the work that's been done so far has been in the field of depression. What we know in depression is that it seems that individuals who suffer from depression or who are vulnerable for depression are more likely to inhibit positive emotions, dampen, avoid those emotions. And it seems that that is really maybe critical to prolonging that negative mood. And researchers are also finding that if parents are reacting to children in ways that are communicating that positive emotions are bad, that also may have some risks for depression in kids. There's been almost no work, though, on ADHD. So I'm not a depression researcher. I'm an ADHD researcher. But I'm interested in how does this work for kids with ADHD. They struggle a lot to regulate negative emotions. I think they also struggle to regulate positive emotions, but we don't have a lot of data on that yet. And I imagine, though, that parents could matter, but it might be a very different landscape of behaviors and sort of challenges. So in my lab, what we've done, part of this was a little bit of the COVID interruption in my research, is that we decided to do a really large survey of parents. So we collected a sample of over 100 parents of 6 to 12-year-old children. And we asked them a number of questions that were focused on their child's ADHD symptoms, how their child regulated positive emotions, and also what they did as a parent in terms of reacting when their child had positive emotions. Okay? So this is data that we got about a year ago, and my three wonderful honors thesis students from this past year have been looking at this data to try to get some initial information about how these processes may look. So I'm going to tell you about what each of them found. I'm giving you a snippet. So their theses were far larger, but I'm going to give you a preview because we don't have enough time, okay? So one of my thesis students was Ray Corcoran, and Ray was really interested in this question of whether or not children with ADHD may struggle with regulating positive emotions, okay? And so in our large survey of parents, we asked parents to rate how children coped or what they did when they experienced positive emotions, like being happy. And in our scale, we were measuring three different kinds of ways that children could be sort of coping with positive emotions. So one of them is that children might inhibit positive emotions. This is the one that's most tied to like depression risk. So as in, when children feel happy, do they try to push those emotions away? They don't want to talk about it. They want to avoid it. So they're just kind of pushing it away, all right? So we looked at inhibiting positive emotions. We looked at dysregulation of positive emotions. So this is when your child is happy, do they become out of control? Do they get impulsive? Is it difficult for them to manage their behavior? So really kind of looking at more that dysregulated behavior pattern. We also had questions that focused on this idea of savoring. So this is really the adaptive piece over here. Savoring is really the extent to which you can enjoy, relish, and prolong those positive emotions. So it's probably what we would like kids to be able to do. So parents reported using a rating scale on what their child was doing across these three domains. We also measured, though, in our study, children's ADHD symptom levels. And so what Ray did is they basically divided our sample into children who had clinically elevated ADHD symptoms and those that didn't. And then they compared them on these three different domains, okay? And what we found is that the children who had the clinically elevated ADHD symptoms, they didn't look any different from kids without those symptoms in terms of inhibiting. So that doesn't seem to be part of the landscape of challenges that children with ADHD have. Maybe that's really the depression world. But they did have higher levels of dysregulation of positive emotions, so acting out, having difficulty controlling themselves when they were happy. And they were also, though, less likely to savor, to be able to relish and enjoy those positive emotions in a way that would be adaptive. So this is actually some of the first data that's actually looked at what might be different in children with ADHD, and it certainly does suggest that they may struggle in a unique way with also regulating positive emotions. Okay. One of the other things that we looked at in this study that we measured in this large survey sample of parents is that we wanted to look at parents' socialization of positive emotions. So how are parents reacting when their children experience positive emotions? There are a couple measures out there, but those measures, I think, were really designed to understand implications for depression, and they ask a lot about what are parents doing in those run-of-the-mill moments when your kid is just happy. And so it was really these benign kind of experiences. I was really interested in what are parents doing when their kids are showing strong positive emotions. So they're like really getting silly. They're really excited, or they're really happy. So what we ended up doing in our lab is we designed a new measure because we didn't like what was out there, where we came up with some situations describing children experiencing strong positive emotions. And in our survey, we asked parents about the likelihood that they would react in a variety of ways. And what we found in terms of how these responses shook out is that it seemed that there were these two broader categories of ways that parents might respond. One of them we called dampening. And these were really reactions that we would think would reduce those strong positive emotions. It included things like just ignore, don't pay any attention to my kid when they're really silly and excited. It included minimizing it, like it's not a big deal, like don't make anything out of this. It also included getting irritated with the child or annoyed with the child for having those positive emotions. So we called that dampening. The other major category was that there were also reactions that seemed to fall under the idea of enhancing, which would be that we would imagine these are reactions that would make those positive emotions continue. This included things like the parent might react and be positive also, so share that emotion with the child. It also included talking with the child or doing something to try to prolong or keep that emotion going. And it also included doing something to try to help the child pay attention to that they're having an emotion, like, oh, wow, you're feeling really excited right now. So we had these two kind of broad categories. And so my other two thesis students looked into like what might be going on in terms of this socialization of positive emotions. So Kate Redman, she was really interested in trying to understand the link between parents' reactions to strong positive emotions and the child's own emotion regulation of positive emotions. And so we know that connection is there when we're talking about negative emotions. We would hope it would be there also for positive emotions. And so she was thinking about those three domains that I talked about, so inhibiting, dysregulation of positive emotions, and savoring positive emotions. And so she wanted to see if there was a connection. Here's what she found. When it came to dampening positive emotions. So this is that the parent's either ignoring those really strong positive emotions, or they're minimizing them, or they're getting annoyed with them. We found what we would have expected. Basically, the more parents are saying they're dampening, the more children themselves are inhibiting their positive emotions, the more the child tends to be dysregulated in their positive emotions, and the less they're savoring. This is just correlational data. But maybe what it means is that there is this connection of teaching, so that parents' reactions may be kind of teaching these kinds of strategies to the child. I think that's what we would hypothesize is going on here. So she also looked at enhancing. So those enhancing reactions were things like, do you share that positive emotion? Do you help the child notice that they're feeling excited? Do you try to prolong it in some way or magnify it? What she found is that the more parents were enhancing positive emotions, the less the child would inhibit their own positive emotions, that makes sense, and the more that the child would savor.
Again, I think that makes sense. Then she found this an interesting association. For dysregulation, what she found is that actually the more parents say that they're enhancing their child's very strong positive emotions, the more dysregulated kids are when they experience positive emotions. So she and I have spent many an hour discussing what that finding might mean. And I think what we've landed on, and this is all preliminary, right? So we've got plenty left to do, is that maybe what we're seeing here is that it's because we're really focusing on strong positive emotions, and maybe there is a subset of children for which further enhancing a positive emotion tips them into the land of dysregulation. They're already really excited. They're already really silly. So it may be that that's not always an effective parenting strategy. And my guess is that there is some internal vulnerability here that matters, that this is problematic for some children, but maybe not all. So we'll try to figure that out. My other thesis student is Maya Foster. Maya was also interested in this question of like how are parents socializing children around positive emotions. But Maya's real question was about, are there differences based on race and ethnicity? And the larger field of parent emotion socialization, which is mostly focused on how are we parenting negative emotions, certainly suggests that cultural values matter. We have different understanding and comfort and beliefs about emotions, and so those do affect what parents are doing. It's also the case that parents may socialize children around negative emotions differently based on race because of the potential ramifications. So there's some interesting research suggesting that Black families may be more likely to try to dampen down negative emotions in their children, and that may be because of concerns about how are those negative emotions going to be perceived by others, that they may be treated unjustly if they were to get really upset in a public situation or something like that. So this does suggest that there could be race and ethnic differences. There was really no one who had really thought about this question, though, when we think about how parents might parent positive emotions. And so Maya wanted to take this up. What she found, where she found a difference, is that she found a difference in terms of dampening. So what she did is she compared, this was a large nationally representative sample. We had 800 parents. So she was able to compare parents who were Black, parents who were Latino, and parents who were white. And this is what she found in terms of parent dampening, okay? So here's our three different race ethnicities over here. We're looking at parent dampening. So the higher that bar is, the more frequently parents are saying that they're engaging in this behavior. And what we found is that actually white parents were more likely, significantly more likely to say that they would dampen their child's strong positive emotions relative to Latino and African American parents. So that's really a flip of the kind of difference we tend to see with negative emotions, where there's research suggesting that African American and Latino parents actually will dampen negative emotions more so in their children, but not for positive. And when Maya then went back to the literature more broadly, she did find that there were these cultural differences in sort of emotional expressivity and the value of positive emotions, and that she was finding, there's a lot more research on Latino parents in this regard, but that for Latino individuals, they may really value positive emotions, value the idea of expressing those, and so it may not be culturally a problem to have strong positive emotions, and that might be different.
What is your y-axis there? I'm not sure I understand.
How frequent they would dampen their child's positive emotions. So the higher the bar means parents are saying, I do this more often. So that's Maya's work. So I'll leave us here, and then I'll sort of ask if there's any questions. So what I've learned, what maybe you've learned from some of this research, one thing is that I do think parents are powerful. I think that the evidence from my research and the broader literature suggests that we can teach children about emotions and how to regulate them, that we may have downstream effects on their social adjustment. But of course, children aren't all the same, okay? And so it may really depend on the child and their own internal vulnerabilities, the extent to which that kind of parenting really, really matters. I think I've also learned from this work that context really matters in many different ways. It probably depends on where are those emotions coming from? Is it a small moment or is it a large moment? My 5-year-old had a meltdown a couple mornings ago because his cereal bar broke in half.
That was a moment in which I was non-supportive, and I minimized that because I just felt like that was just not it. So the context may matter in that sense. The context may matter in terms of, are we talking about positive emotions versus negative emotions? It may matter in terms of a person's own identity and the values that that family holds around emotions. So there's a lot of nuance. I always feel like, too, I should end on a note that, like, nobody's perfect. I think when we talk about research with parents, there can be a tendency to then say, parents are the whole problem, or parents could fix it, or they are so responsible. And the truth is that I have significant effects here, but there's also lots of additional variability and lots of other factors that influence children. And of course, parents are not perfect in all moments. These are general trends based on what parents are telling us. It's also the case that kids aren't perfect, that kids struggle. They struggle in many different ways, and that we may not always, as parents, be able to stop that or protect that. And so I think that's important to say. I think the hope of this work, though, is it suggests that we can move the needle. It also does turn out, though, that parents are very malleable. We are teachable. And so there's a lot of work being done showing that parents can be trained to react to their children differently. And so it actually is a really effective inroad to supporting children who may be struggling. So I do think there's promise there. I want to just thank the students that have worked in my lab. There's lots more than just this, but this is a snippet of some of the students who've been here. I will say that these students get paid to work in my lab. That's really the only way that that can happen for them because of their other responsibilities. So they work in the summer in my research lab. They work during the year. I've had numerous students go on to get their PhDs and go to medical school and have really wonderful careers and contribute to the world. And where we get the funding from that is from alumni donations. And so I thank anyone who has been supporting Amherst College and making these important opportunities possible that both contribute to science and student development. And I'm happy to answer questions. My email is up there, but you can also find me. If you want to see the published articles, you can email me. I'll send them to you. Or if you have other questions, you can always get in touch. Yes?
Were all the children medicated?
No, there was a lot of variability. And so what we did is when we first assessed them, and when we did those physiological measures, they had a washout period, so they were not on their stimulant medication for a long enough period, so it was out of their system. And we actually excluded children who were on medications that couldn't be withdrawn like that. But by the time we got to those follow-ups, things changed, and so some kids were medicated, and so things could be different. I haven't, but there's a ton of research on that, and I think the data in general suggests that that it is a highly effective intervention to train parents in how to respond to their children with ADHD in ways that can really set them up for success and mitigate those impairments. I think there's a debate in the field if it's better than medication or if you do better if you do that and medication. The interesting thing is, though, the way that they're training parents is really in discipline strategies, structure, rewarding appropriate behavior. The field of ADHD has really not paid attention to emotions. And so they're just starting to develop interventions where they're thinking about, oh, maybe we should also help parents to respond to these strong emotions in ways that are helpful. So there's definitely a lot of empirical evidence to suggest parents can be a critical part of therapy for children with ADHD, but not what I'm doing, they're just starting. And what we have out there suggests that if you teach parents these kinds of skills, you can see benefits, particularly to emotion regulation, but it's very new that they're doing that work. I know. It's harder for me to do treatment work here without grad students, but I agree. Yeah, and one of the grad students that I worked with, a grad student from UMass, who's now an assistant professor at UVA, and she is doing some of that work.
Is there any correlation between how parents
I would love to know. And I don't have the data, nor do I think anyone's looked at it. I think that's another really good question. And the field of understanding positive emotions is in such an infancy that I would say no. One of the things I would say anecdotally I've noticed specifically about children with ADHD is that they can have these very mixed profiles where they're becoming very excited or very silly, and it tips really fast into negative emotion, frustration, anger. And so I think that's a really good question around the balance of those things. It's great. Let's do that study. Yeah. Yeah.
Could you say something about the size of the effects you're seeing? You've been kind enough not to bring up p-factors or graphs, but just anecdotally, are these effects that jump out at you, or are they, do you have to really dig for them?
These are actually, I'd say, medium effect sizes. My sample, especially for the physiological data, is very small. So anything that pops out as significant has to be at least a medium effect size. I think they're not negligible. Mm-hmm. It's hard in clinical psychology to get larger than a medium effect size. And so I think these things matter, and they're not everything. I don't know if that helps you.
Yeah. Looking for just a subjective take on it.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what I would say. Yeah.
Any significant differences between boys and girls, especially given that girls are kind of historically underdiagnosed?
Yeah.
Yes.
So I have been lucky. I think it was chance, but I have a good representation of girls with ADHD in my samples, and I have surprisingly found very few gender differences. And I'm not sure what to make of that. Certainly in the larger field, there's a lot of research suggesting, not a lot, but there's research suggesting that parents are parenting boys and girls differently in terms of how they react to their emotions based on gender role ideas, I think. I am not finding that in my samples, both even in my large nationally representative sample for positive emotions. I wonder sometimes if there are cohort differences. Gender norms change and parenting changes, and so if that's part of it. I do think, too, girls with ADHD struggle in unique ways, and that might be washing out some of the gender differences I would see if maybe this wasn't a half ADHD sample. That's a good question. Do you mean causative as in maybe it's influenced by parent emotion socialization?
Is the physiologic difference between sympathetic and parasympathetic, does that in any way cause their psychological response, or is it just a marker for their psychological response?
That is a huge debate in the field that I think is part of the messiness of these biological markers, in that objectively what we're really seeing is a change in heart rate variability and skin conductance level. And researchers are trying to understand what that's marking. And I think it's very difficult for us to know if it's really causing, or it's a consequence of, or even really it's a marker of. You may have noticed I was very tentative in my language. There is a lot of, there's differences of opinion in what these biological markers mean. And so it's a little bit of a messy field, even though I do think it's valuable and helpful in understanding differences. So I don't know, I sort of skirted your answering, but that's my best. That's my best. Yes.
Anything in your data about evaluation of parents and whether any of them have ADHD and how the different populations of parents
So when I started this research, it was like I started this in 2013, and it's one of my biggest regrets is that I didn't measure parent ADHD symptom levels. There's been a lot of new research coming out about how that contributes, and I would love to know. I think there are some other folks doing some of that work, but I don't have that information. In all of my future studies, I am including it. Yes.
How strong is the correlation between parasympathetic versus sympathetic response to stress on one hand, and whether the child is ADHD or not on the other?
Those are really good questions. So in terms of parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, the correlation is small, it's negative, and it's very small effect size. And one of the reasons for that is that even though they're thought of as almost like opposite sides of a coin, that's not actually how everyone's physiology works. And so we can have really different patterns across individuals in those two systems. And from a researcher perspective, that's nice in that there's lots of variability in profiles that we can then look at. Children, I have another study where we looked at whether children with ADHD showed a different profile. And they did, what they showed in general, I'll show you the picture just so it rings a bell. They showed that basically this like aberrant emotion regulation profile. So their parasympathetic nervous system, basically they were very insensitive. Their parasympathetic nervous system was not reacting in the way that we would expect. And so basically the way this system works is it's almost like the gas is the brake on a car. And one of the ways we can activate our system without using a lot of energy is you can take your foot off the brake. And so this profile is sort of like take your foot off the brake. And so that is a really easy way to kind of regulate emotions. Children with ADHD aren't doing that. So they do show this. In these analyses, I accounted for that effect. So this is kind of in addition to any effect that ADHD is having on these variables. So it isn't explained away by like that these are actually children with ADHD and not that it's not that profile, if that helps you. Yeah.
Yeah, not exactly on what you're talking about, but since you're an expert, ADHD,
yeah. It's a hard one. I definitely think that ADHD medication is extremely helpful for children with this disorder and can relieve suffering for sure. The question of over-medication is hard. I think that we more and more, we ask a lot of children, we have much less flexibility in schools, we have much less funding for schools to help support all children, and that may be driving up some of these medication rates. Pharmaceutical companies do have money. They make money off of these things. And so the question of over-medication, a lot of researchers are looking at it, and I think it's very hard to understand. It's regionally very different, school system different. Actually, in terms of like race ethnicity, what the newer data is suggesting actually is that white children are far more likely to be assigned a diagnosis of ADHD and to be medicated for ADHD compared to Latino children and Black children. And that, though, seems to be much more about access and willingness and trust of our medical system, which would be understandable. It also may be that teachers are not spotting and sort of thinking that is ADHD when they see a child misbehave or struggle who's not white, and they may be giving other labels to those behaviors that this is a bad kid. And so it's actually, I think, really complicated around the over-medication versus that there may be some children we are missing. And one of the things we know that's one of the best predictors for children with ADHD of long-term better outcomes is that they get early support and early treatment. And so for the kids that are missed, who are not getting supports, whether it is medication or it's school intervention, those are the kids that are going to fare the worst and are most likely to suffer from other challenges down the line. So there's this tricky balance around we certainly don't want to medicate all kids, and we don't want to do that too much. And also, if there are children who are struggling, we want to support them. We want to support them early because there are many things that children with ADHD can learn as compensatory strategies that can help mitigate some of these challenges. It doesn't mean they're gone, but it does mean that they don't have to be as impairing. Yeah, it's such a great question, and I don't have that data. It's one of the things I'd really like to do in my next study is to measure these factors multiple times, like yearly over multiple years, and then I think you could start to get at some of those questions of what's driving what over time, what happens when parenting changes, does the child react, like do they respond in turn or not? Is it that there's also, you know, I thought about these models very much in terms of the parent leading to the child's social emotional adjustment. Anyone who's a parent also knows that like there are sometimes your child is emotional and that might pull for certain reactions from us, you know, so that it may not also work as a one-way street, but I would need different data. I hope I get that data. That's on my mind.
Thank you. question about fathers and four yeah. children and mothers. Fathers and mothers.
Yeah.
Any data?
So my study is about 85% moms. And we sort of said whoever is a primary caretaker can come in. So I don't have a lot of data on dads. In the field more generally, it's really a mixed bag whether they find differences between fathers and mothers and what those differences are. So I don't think I see a clear signal. It's also unfortunate, you know, this kind of data, it would be great if we had been collecting this data for 50 years so that we really could see those changes. I don't think anyone has. And so I think it's an open question, and I think without the data from the past, it's hard to really know. And so I think it's a really good question. There's some researchers are trying to do much more interesting studies around like the balance, and so looking at both the father and the mother and what each of them are bringing to the table and how that might work. And, you know, do both people need to be really good at this? Is it okay if just one is? I think those are really great questions. The logistics of getting two parents to show up in a research lab when they have little kids is just such a mess that I have not taken it on. I hope someone is, or I think it's a really good question. I'm gonna take one more, and then I think I'm out of time because I have to go pick up my kids. Yes, Lakers.
All right.
It's a really good question. There is certainly high comorbidity between ADHD and bipolar disorder in the direction of if you have bipolar disorder, many of those individuals also have ADHD. I think it's sometimes hard to understand, is it really ADHD or are you having trouble paying attention and are you impulsive because of your bipolar disorder? I'm not sure that I've seen that there's a lot of research that undiagnosed ADHD is necessarily leading to bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder tends to be more of a chronic condition. So they are comorbid. I do think in general, when kids are missed and they are not diagnosed, that can really is linked to a lot of different disorders in adulthood. So higher rates of depression, higher rates of eating disorders in women, higher rates of borderline personality disorder, of substance use problems. And so it certainly is really damaging when I think children are not being properly labeled. One of the things I've talked about in my other work is that might be so invalidating for those kids. They are struggling in all these ways and they're never given any sort of explanation or reason and they're not maybe being provided the right supports and what it would mean to sort of experience that for a long time.
Now,
yeah.
The reason I asked that is because I have a
problem. Yeah, and I do think in general, some individuals may not have developed some of these skills around independence and emotion regulation that we hope you get by the time you reach adulthood. And that is unfortunate, and I think it's really hard. Like these years of adolescent, childhood to adolescence are the years to get some of that. And sometimes kids don't for a variety of reasons. And then that really can have effects when we reach adulthood and we're expected to be independent and be responsible and be able to regulate our emotions and do all of these things. And the truth is not all of us are great at it. That is true. Well, thank you for all your great questions. It's nice to have you here. I hope you enjoy your weekend.